was made to cope. Ideas in decline. Rise of the lost. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swags the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Franz, a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. His books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Franz.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And my understanding from a BBC article I read recently that you were quoted in is that this is going to be a $6 billion election. Is that?
Yeah. Well, it has the potential to be yes, one of the most expensive, probably the most expensive electoral cycle in American history.
And how is that figure calculated? Because I guess we don't really quite know about how much money is really being spent. Because there's no real obligation on the part of a lot of the big super PAC donors, particularly some of the billionaires, to reveal who they are because of this 501c4 fiction to do with what some sort of charitable giving. Isn't that the rubric under which it operates?
Yes, yes. Many of these new interest groups that are advertising in campaigns are registered as sort of nonprofit social welfare groups that don't show up in sort of Federal Election Commission reports. One of the ways that we can calculate their spending is through the project that I'm affiliated with, the Wesleyan Media Project. We can just capture ads that that mention candidates, feature candidates in their ads, and then we know how often those ads air, and then we can use that to kind of come up with an estimate of how much was spent by these groups, regardless of whether they register with the commission. So we do have some handle on how much is being spent on TV, but of course there's other ways that these groups can spend money in campaigns that isn't as easily or systematically tracked, such as sort of mobilizing voters off the air and so forth.
So the $6 billion figure, of course, is more than the annual GDP of a lot of third world countries. It's a disturbing amount of money. And as you've just mentioned, Michael Franz, most of it goes to the media monopolies.
Yes. I mean, the majority of a candidate's candidate's budget in a competitive House or Senate race in most cases would go to funding television advertising. And that also is increasingly including costs for social media advertising, social media outreach, ads on YouTube, ads on Facebook, and so forth, which are cheaper, but are also kind of adding to the candidates' budget, because we're not seeing a decline in TV ads in terms of how many are being aired. We're seeing an increase, and so as candidates are spending more money on TV ads, and they're also spending more money on new media, the cost of campaigns is consequently rising, and the major beneficiaries of this oftentimes are TV stations who just reap, basically rake the money in a competitive state when two candidates are fighting each other back and forth.
So one would assume then that the media monopolies have little to no interest in reforming a political process that rewards them so handsomely.
No, very, very little. I mean, if you were to imagine, and some reformers have pushed this over the years, free advertising for candidates and so forth, under the presumption that the government owns the airwaves, especially broadcast stations. You know, there would be a huge pushback from the broadcasting industry in terms of fighting that kind of grab from the government, because it would be perceived as a major loss of revenue for these stations. And so, yes, I mean, there's very little chance that we'd see any reform in that nature, given the financial interests that TV stations have in keeping campaigns costly.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Franz, who's a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. And his books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. So according to Michael Toner, the former chair of the U.S. Federal Elections Commission, as far as he's concerned, the sky's the limit in terms of price tags. He thinks that you can't spend too much and sees the enormous amounts of spending that's going on as a good thing, that it engages voters and makes them more likely to turn out. Do you share that notion?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the notion. I think that what ends up happening oftentimes when campaigns don't outreach as much to voters, perhaps if campaigns there were a cap on how much candidates could spend and so forth, would be that voters would oftentimes rely on other factors to make their decisions, such as party identification or what friends and family had urged them to do, as opposed to making their own independent judgment, which could come from being exposed to a campaign. And being exposed to a campaign means the campaign needs to be out there spending money. What we don't necessarily, or what I might necessarily split from the conventional wisdom on that issue, is that sort of raw dollar value, more is better, doesn't take into account oftentimes the different content of campaigns that can come with spending a lot of money. So super PACs are going to spend a lot of money, but that's not necessarily more is better, because they're going to be spending a lot of money on pretty nasty, negative, mudslinging campaign ads. And that may not be the best kind of discourse that we hope for. Whereas campaigning is definitely useful for people, it's you definitely have to pay attention also to the way campaigns are waged.
So, Michael Franz, I have a problem, though, with just this disparity or this disconnect in our democracy. There are about 5 million eligible voters in America who voted before who are being denied the vote because of new laws put through by Republicans that essentially force them to jump through hoops to identify who they are. But meanwhile, a handful of billionaires who appear to be buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. So to me, that is just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely an important distinction to make, an important point to note, because, yes, you're having the sense of voters who show up at the polls being required to disclose who they are with and prove who they are, but plenty of funders of campaign ads hiding behind an assumed anonymity right that exists in the First Amendment, which it does not. There's no right to political anonymity in our democracy. So, yes, I mean, it's the same forces that are standing up urging people to show up at the polls with proof that they are who they are should be the same people who are requiring or demanding that the people who are funding these ads through these nonprofits also stand behind who they are and disclose the identity of the funders and make it as accessible to the public as possible.
So how does this compare, though, to other countries? I mean, I know how other countries operate, particularly the kind of money that's spent. In the United Kingdom, for example, a total of £31 million, that's about $50 million, was spent by all parties in the last general election in the UK 2 years ago, making U.S. spending 120 times as much and 23 times as much per person. Again, I have problems with that. I just don't understand why it is that this has to go on for so long and why it is necessary to spend this much money. And if you make our politics about money, you make it about money, it means people with money are going to win. But if you make it about issues and candidates, at least we can have some semblance of democracy.
Well, we have a political system, or at least an electoral system, that you wouldn't really ever design from scratch. I mean, the consequences of what we have now in terms of our campaign finance laws are a patchwork of decisions and jurisprudence that has sort of made a mockery of any sort of rational system. And I think a good example of that, beyond the length of our campaign, which is extraordinarily long, our presidential elections last now for 2 years, in actuality, not only candidates who are preparing to run prior to even that, but we have a system that is now increasingly rewarding non-political parties and non-candidates, but rewarding funders of these shadowy groups. And they're not as easily held accountable by voters. We don't necessarily know who's behind them. And the political parties are being handcuffed by a set of rules that limit what they can raise and spend, just like the candidates. And they're being increasingly marginalized by these super PACs and these outside groups that have no rules that apply to them anymore. And so what that results in is a lot of political speech, but coming from a diversity of speakers that have no accountability. And I think that's not exactly an ideal political situation to have. If anything, we should, you know, and there's controversy about this proposed change, we should try to reinforce the parties in our political system to make the parties have more responsibility for political speech, marginalize the super PACs. And this would at least allow voters to have a better handle over what's coming on their television screens. If they see it coming from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or from Republican candidates or Democratic candidates, they can more easily sort of sort that into their own predispositions. But when it's coming from the Center for American Democracy and you have no way of knowing who's behind the Center for American Democracy, that's sort of making a mockery of sort of the transparency that we'd like in our system.
So, Michael Frantz, your books, of course, include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. Since you've been watching elections for some time, it seems to me that this election is, particularly on the Republican side, is so flagrantly devoid of any, I think it's deeply cynical, frankly, most of the advertising that Mitt Romney's put up, starting with the first ad that he put out back in Iowa, where he put John McCain's words in Barack Obama's mouth. And the latest ones are the one about the welfare waivers. Everybody involved has been screaming from the rafters, including the architect of welfare reform, Bill Clinton, about how dishonest and duplicitous the ad is. It's clearly targeted at blue-collar, so-called Reagan Democrats to get them angry and make them feel that somehow Obama's giving their money away to a bunch of minority freeloaders. So we understand the motives and we understand why they're doing it, but I just don't feel that there's any mechanism in this country to call people out on this flagrant dishonesty. There are a few fact-checking organizations, but that's usually after the horse is way down the paddock and the barn door is way open.
No, you're right. I mean, the fact-checking that goes on and that is really well done is few and far between. There are, you know, in any given presidential election, you know, this year there might be 200 or 300 separate Romney ads and 200 or 300 separately crafted Obama ads, and there's no way that the fact checkers are going to check all of those. They check the highest profile ones and so forth. I think it's incumbent upon voters to take a little bit more responsibility, perhaps, in what they believe or what they accept as valuable information. I mean, sort of the boots on the ground here is the individual voter who's watching television, who sees an ad and decides whether or not they're going to accept it or not. I think what they should do is they should talk more about these ads. They should talk more about the thinking they have in the way they're going to vote and see if that can sort of help perhaps blunt sort of a simple message coming their way that then impacts their thinking on a candidate or an issue. The more we talk about these with people and the more we try to engage people who disagree with us, the more Republicans talk to Democrats and Democrats talk to Republicans, the better off we'll be in our political system. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be entirely civil all the time and we might end up having some heated conversations, but in a culture where we sort of pit religion and politics as things we should never discuss with one another, I think we end up doing ourselves an added disservice when our political system is increasingly being run by these big funders. We need to start talking more about these things and taking responsibility for the way we act politically.
Well, Michael Frantz, if we look at what happened in the last election, if you will, in Wisconsin, the recall election, where the state was blanketed with not just TV advertising, but with also flyers in the mail and people knocking on your door, all stops were pulled out there. And the expectation is that as we get closer to November, similar activities are going to happen nationwide. There's going to be a last-minute saturation, or it's been often referred to as carpet bombing advertising campaigns. And I'm just wondering, and in those conditions, of course, there's more money chasing airtime. That's how much the media people are sitting in the catbird seat here. What's the psychological effect of this? It seems to me that it sort of almost has a kind of Stockholm syndrome thing to it, where you just you know, eventually just identify with your torturer just to get it over with, you know?
It's possible. I mean, I think what seems more likely is that there's declining marginal returns for most of this advertising. And so, you know, you might be affected by the ads that you see, but when you've seen them 50 times, you don't listen to them anymore as much. So there is a really tricky kind of needle you try to thread in running your campaign ads, which is you don't want to go up too early and blanket the airwaves in all these places and reach that sort of plateau of decreasing effectiveness way before people end up making their decision. But you don't want to go too late with most of your advertising so that the other side has been able to define you without you being on TV. And so candidates, in the end, end up risking the problem of the former rather than the problem of the latter, and they end up advertising sort of continuously. But what ends up happening is voters sort of end up sort of stop listening to the ads that they see continuously, and the effect can, you know, kind of just kind of sort of plateau. But that is particularly something that isn't very harmful, perhaps, when both sides are advertising in equal amounts. You know, then it ends up sort of canceling each other out. But when one particular side has a big advantage, then they can move a number of voters to your camp. And so what you mentioned might be possible, but only when candidates are really have sort of, or when one side has a sort of the stage to themselves.
Well, just in closing, I recently spoke with a couple of campaign professionals, one who ran John McCain's 2008 campaign and another run a number of Democratic presidential and senatorial campaigns. And they both said that the depressing thing about our democracy is that most of this advertising and activity goes on only in the swing states. So most of the country doesn't even know there's an election going on.
Right.
And they pour all this money into these swing states, wall-to-wall advertising. And then in late October, and we're talking about only less than 20% of the country, but by late October, then they started targeting the undecided. And if you are undecided in late October, you tend to be a kind of ignorant couch potato that doesn't read newspapers or know what the hell is going on. And that is the demographic that they finally target in the home stretch. So it makes you sort of depressed about the whole idea of our democracy. In the end, the people, the swing voters, are perhaps our most ignorant citizens.
Well, you know, I think the other thing, I mean, there's also a bit of a split perhaps you might have in whether or not swing voters, or let's call them undecided voters, are regular voters or not. And so an undecided voter who rarely votes or who isn't going to vote or is very unlikely to vote in a presidential election is what you more than likely describe. I have absolutely no problem being highly critical of that person's political engagement if they're not going to vote in an incredibly important presidential election. But the undecided voter in a swing state who is a regular voter is probably not the couch potato, but probably someone who may literally be conflicted over whether or not Obama or McCain in, say, 2008 was better for this country, or who might have who might like Obama but who really doesn't know if his policies have been successful. And those folks are just sort of waiting to figure out what they really want to do. And I wouldn't be as critical as them. But I really think the big problem in our political system is exactly what you described with the Electoral College, that segmented electorate that we have focusing on four or five states at the very end is a huge disservice to a national discussion that we should be having about the presidential election. I think we need a popular vote to decide our presidential elections, which would consequently force candidates to engage everywhere, because every vote would count. And I think that would just be a far, far better thing for our political system than what we have today.
Well, Michael Franz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Franz, who's a professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He is currently co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. His books include Campaign Advertising in American Democracy and Choices and Changes, Interest Groups in the Electoral Process. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.
standing on the street, one time, one night in America.